Texas, always big, is growing. It has three of the nation's 10 largest cities and an economy as big as Canada's, but its traditional culture maintains a strong pull. One out of every four vehicles purchased in the state is a pickup. Those are some of the things you'll find in the new book by our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book is a reflection on his home state, its natural beauty, its racial and ethnic diversity, its music, and its political culture, characterized by a strong rightward tilt, and a cast of characters so colorful, Wright says they're a journalist's dream. Wright says that Texas, the largest red state in the Union, will eventually move into the blue column and change the nation's politics in the process. Wright's new book is called God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. His Pulitzer Prize-winning book about Al-Qaeda and 9/11, The Looming Tower, was recently adapted into a Hulu series. His book about Scientology was adapted into an HBO docuseries. Lawrence Wright spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Lawrence Wright, welcome back to Fresh Air. You write in this book that you spent a good part of your childhood in Abilene, which is way up in West Texas, and then in East Dallas, where your dad had a bank. And you decided as you graduated high school that you wanted to get out of the state. Why?
Well, I felt I was living a very provincial life, and I wanted to see the world. Well, there's another thing, Dave. When I was in high school, that's when John F. Kennedy came to town and was assassinated. And there was a huge stigma from being from Dallas during that period of time. And I guess in some ways I wanted to get away from that. The conformity, the fanaticism that characterized the city were also off-putting to me. I wanted to go someplace that was, felt like it was liberated. And Dallas during that period of time was not that place.
So you went off and made quite a career as a journalist. You lived in Egypt, did a lot of things. And then in 1979, you were living in Atlanta and were lured back. How? What happened?
I was writing for Look magazine at that time about the 12 men that walked on the moon. And one of them, Charlie Duke, was then walking on New Braunfels, Texas, a nice little German Czech town in central Texas. So I went to New Braunfels, and there was a little bed and breakfast they checked me into. It had a Rathskeller in the basement, and I thought, I'll go get a beer and a brat and walk around the square, and that'll be Saturday night in New Braunfels. But I ran into Texas Monthly's restaurant critic at the time, Frank Bailey, and he totally defeated my idea. We went off on a gallivant around the hill country, stopped at a steakhouse where he ordered a 3-inch steak rare, which was one of the most disgusting things I ever saw. It was like a bleeding brick. And then we did a little tour of the dance halls and wound up in Green, Texas, Texas' oldest dance hall. And a young man named George Strait was opening the show, and a band called Asleep at the Wheel was playing. And it was, it felt really familiar and joyful. And just all the accents and the music, and I just felt called home. And coincidentally, like a month later, I got a call from the editor of Texas Monthly, Bill Broyles. And by the end of the call, I was moving back home.
Hmm. Yeah, I have been to Green, which is spelled G-R-U-E-N-E, right?
Right.
My cousin Mark was married there. A lot of journalists who write about things that you have written about would want to be in New York. Did you feel you were giving something up?
Yeah, I have no reason to be living in Austin. It's just where I live. But my career is in New York and L.A. and to some extent in Washington. And there's some puzzlement among my colleagues about why I would be in Texas. Because, when I moved to Texas in 1980 to write for Texas Monthly, I only lasted on the staff for 6 months. I continued to write for that magazine, but really, I wanted to write about other things. And I sort of swore off writing about Texas because I didn't want to be seen as a regional writer. But, it turns out I have a lot to say about it. It's a very meaningful place to live.
You have a chapter called culture explained. You see, there's level one of Texas culture and a level two. What's the distinction you're drawing?
Well, I say there are three levels of culture, and level one is the basic primitive stuff that we think of in the case of Texas, like barbecue and cowboy hats and boots and belt buckles and rodeos, and that's all, you know, very characteristic of the state, and it's the kind of thing, you know, that people think of when they think of Texas, and you know, that was true of Texas in its formative days, and it continues in a form of nostalgia. Level two is when money comes into the picture and people begin to explore outside of their native culture, and they get educated, they travel, they learn about different cuisines, they start collecting art and building museums and theater companies and dance companies, and all of the world rushes in, and that is, you know, it's an important stage, but it's a bit neurotic. And it's full of envy. It's casting its eye on other cultures and what they have to offer. And there's a deep sense of insecurity about that level. And
you
really
see this in the big museums and performance venues in, what, Dallas and Houston and other places, right?
Sure. And in, you know, and in the education that we get, you know, sending your children abroad and so on. You go out in the world and you learn about it. And that's very important, but it creates a sense of estrangement and some ways a sense of embarrassment about level one, the primitive stuff that goes together that makes your culture unique. And then, you know, I postulate a third level when you go through that second level and you've learned about the world and you learn what it has to offer, and then you go back and rediscover the things that make your culture so special. And I look around at all the, you know, the artists that have come out of Texas, like Beyonce is a more recent example. Her music, especially her latest music, rediscovers her youth in Houston, and the country music trends and stuff like that she was all, the church music, all of that is reflected in her work now. I think Alvin Ailey, for instance, you know, he came from a little fly speck town called Ranger, but his growing up in that little church in Ranger, you know, it's all reflected in his, especially in his great work Revelation. You know, there are many, many examples of it, but I think that you have to come from a place that has that raw material, go away from that place and learn about the rest of the world, and then in recollection go back and rediscover your roots.
And for you, that's coming back and discovering a long neck beer and the two-step is a lot of fun.
Yeah,
huh?
It is true.
We're a pretty polarized country, and you say that in Texas there's an AM Texas and an FM Texas. What are they?
Well, we're definitely on FM Texas now, Dave. I think people from afar look at Texas as being strictly, you know, an AM entity. You know, it's the right wingers, it's the evangelists, the kinds of shock jock politics that characterizes the state. That's all on AM radio, and if you're turning the dial, you'll find plenty of it. But there is another Texas, which is, you know, more liberal, more progressive, more urbane, and that is what I call FM Texas. And it's really the kingdom of NPR. You know, it's there's an affinity for you know, the kind of culture that FM radio represents in Texas that is just as much Texas as the AM side of it.
And do you think people who have such radically different worldviews and politics interact more and more comfortably in Texas than they do elsewhere?
I think there's some truth to that. You know, a good example is Willie Nelson. Willie is a real lefty. he loves Bernie Sanders. He goes down to the Capitol and advocates for marijuana legalization. He wears clothes made out of hemp, but he's adored by the most right wing of our political figures. Ted Cruz and Dan Patrick and people like that. Our governor, Greg Abbott. All these people love Willie, and yet he represents politically the opposite of what he stands for. But culturally, they're all in the same boat, and that's what unites us.
It's a conservative state politically, but boy, it is big and it is growing. Give us some measure of its, economic power and growing influence over the country.
Well, start with the politics. Texas is the second largest state in the union, but it's growing like crazy. It has 39 electoral votes right now, and probably will gain four more in the next census. California has 55. It's the largest state, but it has not added any more electoral votes since 2003. And New York has been losing population for decades. So Texas is in the ascendance. And, I really think that the future is Texas, because it's where the job growth is, where the population growth is, and has this outsized economic influence in part because of oil. And, the oil was something that I thought was going away in Texas after the big bust in the 80s when oil collapsed. And early 90s, when the amount of oil that America produced was like 5 million barrels a day. It was the lowest point we had been in decades. And the people were talking about peak oil. And for Texas economy, that meant that we were going to be a far less significant player in our national economy than we had been. And then suddenly, fracking comes along. And within 10 years after 2008 to 2018, America's petroleum output doubled. We're now producing more than Saudi Arabia. It's astonishing. And, once again, Texas has become a really important player in the national economy. If Texas were a country of its own, it would have an economy that's somewhat larger than Canada.
You write that there's always been a burlesque side to Texas politics, and a case in point is a character named Rob Morrow, who I hear about from my sister. When I go down there, she says, "You won't believe what's been going on down here." And she told me the story. Tell us about Rob Morrow.
Well, I'd been receiving emails from this guy, like a lot of journalists, I suppose, and he's a conspiracy theorist. He has this idea that that Lyndon Johnson had John Kennedy assassinated, and there's a mountain of conspiracies that he's created, and so he was, just a character on the edge of our political scene when he suddenly ran for the Travis County Republican chairmanship and won. And it was a huge embarrassment for the party, because he shows up wearing a tri-corner jester hat, and his main interest is essentially promoting photographs of nude women, and let's say his interests diverge from the mainstream of the Republican Party widely.
And we should note that Travis County is not some far-flung place. It is Austin. It's the seat of the
exactly.
state's capital. And he has some slogan, which maybe you can't quite say on the radio.
Well, for one thing, one of his campaign slogans was a wet T-shirt contest at the Alamo on 4th of July. he was seen everywhere for a while in that jester hat. And the party had they didn't know what to do with him because they had elected him. And it wasn't until he decided to run for president that they discovered that it was against the law or against the charter of the Travis County GOP to run for president at the same time that you're chairman. So they were able to unload him. And then he showed up at a Trump rally with his hat on and with a big sign saying, "Trump is a child rapist." He's now running for the state chairmanship. So, I don't know if his chances are any wilder than they were in Travis County. So we'll see what happens.
Big personality in a state that loves big personalities, I guess.
It's true. Texas is addicted to colorful characters. And for a reporter, that's a real gift.
You know, people think of Texas as a Republican state and a conservative state, which it is, but it has not always been so uniformly so. And you write about Ann Richards, who was governor of the state in the 1990s, a Democrat and an interesting one. And would you just share the description that you give in the book with us?
Sure. Richards wore designer suits but picked her teeth, and she cleaned her fingernails with a Swiss Army knife. I think she was always a little amazed, after storming the ramparts, to find herself in the seat of power, but she cherished the comedy of the situation. Molly Ivins once told me that when the ACLU filed suit against a manger scene in the Capitol, she called Governor Richards and asked, "Annie, is it really necessary to remove the creche?" "I'm afraid so," Richards replied, "and it's a shame because it's about the only time we ever had three wise men in the Capitol."
And that's Ann Richards being described by our guest Lawrence Wright in his new book, God Save Texas. You once wrote a play about the Texas House of Representatives, which you describe as your favorite political body.
Yeah.
What's distinctive about the Texas legislature?
Well, you know, this is... it's a little bit like a small country's parliament, and maybe not so small. I mean, Texas is a little bit larger than France. So you get a sense of what the state really is when you're actually sitting in the legislature and talking to all these people, and you get a sense of its diversity. You know, the state is really, you know, it's trite to say it, but it really is immense. And, you know, there's a congressional district that's larger than the state of Indiana. So when you actually have the chance to go and talk to all these political figures from all parts of the state, the diversity just really makes an impression on you. And yet, you know, there are a lot of competing interests in Texas right now, and it's a very divided state politically, which I think is somewhat reflected in the nation as a whole. But seeing it all inside this chamber, this beautiful chamber, it's a real education on how politics works now.
Yeah, it's a magnificent sandstone building, the state capitol. But the legislature, it meets only every other year, right, and does a two-year budget?
Yeah, it's part of a constitution of the state, reflected from the days when Texas was a republic. And it reflects the antagonism that Texans have had toward government from the very creation of the republic and then the state.
Right. So if you let politicians in the Capitol only every other year, there's only so much mischief they can do.
Well, I'll tell you, if you spend some time in the Texas Capitol, you'll see the wisdom of that.
We mentioned Ann Richards, who was this Democratic governor, and kind of got in because her opponent in the gubernatorial election sort of self-destructed. And then she was beaten by George W. Bush as part of a conservative wave tide that really kind of swept the state. But, you know, until 2003, you write, the legislature had been held by Democrats for 130 years. How did Republicans cement their control of the state's legislature and congressional delegation when they captured it?
Well, the principal force behind it was Tom Craddock, who was a very conservative representative from West Texas. And he had the imagination and drive to raise the money and tutor these candidates to, about how to go out and knock on people's houses and do the mailers and so on. He really stepped up the game in terms of Texas politics. And, you know, Texas was always a conservative state, but it was blue. When I was a kid, it was, you know, almost entirely blue. And but with Craddock and then Tom DeLay, who was the majority leader in the U.S. House from a community just near Houston here, they kept working to try to get more and more representatives elected specifically to the Texas House, because that is where the redistricting is done.
For Congress, and when, right, and, yes. And the state legislature.
Yes. And in 2003, when they had a majority in the Texas House, they began to carve up the districts in very novel ways. For instance, I live in Austin, and at that time, it was a very historic congressional district, the 10th district, where Lyndon Johnson represented it and others. And Austin is perhaps the most liberal city in the entire southern tier of the United States, from Washington to San Francisco, if you, by some metrics. And it's inside this very red state, which happens also to be the capital. So there's a confluence of, I always think of Austin as being like Rome surrounded by the Goths, you know. And once every other year, they come inside the gates and wreak a lot of harm. But Austin was carved into six different congressional districts, five Republicans and one Democrat. The Democrat, his district now goes from East Austin all the way down to East San Antonio, scooping up as many possible Democrat voters as can get into a single district. My representative, for instance, lives in Weatherford, which is 200 miles away. You know, it's a very vindictive action on the part of the GOP to try to neuter Austin, and it has had some effect. It's, you know, Austin, the sentiments, the political sentiments of the people of Austin are certainly not represented in its congressional delegation.
You write about the legendary Texas legislative session of 2017, which made a lot of headlines in the state and elsewhere.
Yeah.
You write about the legislature's attack on sanctuary cities, big cities where mayors and police chiefs didn't want to routinely hand undocumented immigrants over to immigration authorities, the unwillingness to expand Medicaid or fund public education. But one of the biggest and most public battles was over a bathroom bill that involved transgender people and what bathrooms they can and cannot use. This was pushed by the state's lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick. Quite a character. Tell us about him.
Dan Patrick was a radio personality in Houston. He was kind of a shock jock. He, you know, he had changed his name from Danny Loeb. He came from Baltimore, and where, you know, he worked his way through TV and radio stations until he arrived in Houston with the name Dan Patrick. He began doing sports on a local television station, and he was known for colorful antics, you know, like having cheerleaders paint his body blue while he's giving sportscast, and he had a vasectomy on the air at one point. You know, all in training for a political career. And he, you know, he went bankrupt during the great bust in the 80s, like a lot of Texans, and yet he managed to claw his way back. Essentially, what he did was buy up one of the bankrupt radio stations just outside Houston, just absorbing the debt, I think, through a stroke of luck, he was contacted by someone he had never heard of before who wanted to have a show, and this person was named Rush Limbaugh. And so it was Dan Patrick's radio station that first aired the voice of Rush Limbaugh on a very fertile audience in Houston, Texas. And he became extremely successful with his radio station and several more that he bought. And then he decided to run for office. And he defeated, I don't remember how many it was, but there were like 10 or more candidates that were running in that race. He won outright because of his radio show, and went to the Texas Senate. And within a couple of sessions, he managed to get himself elected lieutenant governor. He is, according to some of my sources, the most conservative person ever elected to statewide office in Texas. And his agenda is not business conservatism. It is the social conservatism that is characterized by the extreme elements of the Tea Party. And the bathroom bill is one example of that.
You're right that a lot of Republicans didn't want to vote for the bathroom bill, but were afraid of the reaction from, you know, people who militantly held this position. And you write about a very influential supporter of the lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, who had some choice words for lawmakers who didn't stand up and do what he regarded as the right thing. Tell us about that.
Well, Dr. Stephen Hotze, he is a medical doctor, and his main business is selling hormones and supplements. But he also has a show on one of Dan Patrick's radio stations. They're in business together. And he's a big supporter of Dan Patrick's and endorsed him. And the kind of invective that comes from Dr. Hotze is toned down in Dan Patrick's speeches. But you can get a sense of the influence that surrounds the Texas politics right now by a prayer that Dr. Hotze issued on his website in 2017. And he says, "There are Texas legislators who would allow perverted men and boys who sexually fantasize that they are women to enter women and girls' bathrooms, showers, and locker rooms." And then he implores his readers to pray with him. "In the name of Jesus, I prophesy and declare, may all the individuals serving in the state legislature and their staff who support, promote, and practice sodomy and other perverted, sexually deviant lifestyles, who support the killing of unborn babies, and who hate God's law and God's word, receive just retribution from God for their evil actions. May they be consumed, collapse, rot, and be blown away as dust from their current positions because of their wicked works, thoughts, and deeds. May people scorn them, and nations abhor them. May their punishment lead them to repentance and faith in Christ. May God's will be done in their lives." That is the voice of a particular wing of Texas politics.
Texas is the biggest red state in the country, with 38 yeah. electoral votes now, probably to grow to, you know, 41 or 42 in a few years.
No, we're thinking 43. We're planning
wow.
to, you know, the idea is, the projections are that it will be four new congressional seats.
But at the same time, the state's demographics are changing. Is it durably Republican? What would be the impact if Democrats were to make some real headway?
Well, you know, it would totally change the national politics if Texas went purple, not to mention blue. And the trends are that direction. You know, the Texas is already, like California, a majority-minority state. And in the Hispanics in Texas don't vote at nearly the rate that they do in California. But should that change, then, you know, Texas would tip, and perhaps could tip dramatically. You know, when I was young, Texas was blue, and it was entirely blue. And California was red. And California and Texas are often seen as these kind of political opposites. But, you know, it was Texas that produced Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, and it was California that produced Ronald Reagan and the modern conservative revolution. Oddly enough, it seems that California is far more a reflection of Lyndon Johnson's politics than Texas of Reagan's. But, you know, these political situations do change and evolve. And, you know, I think, for instance, you know, the anti-gay element inside the Republican Party, for instance, recently in a state convention, they refused to give a booth to the log cabin Republicans who, you know, represent the gay population of the party. Well, it's not just gays who are going to stand aback from that kind of reaction of the party, but people who support tolerance and especially young people for whom, these attacks on gay marriage, for instance, are seen as, incredibly repressive. So if you look at the demographics, which are becoming bluer because of the rising Hispanic vote, and also because Texas is a very urban state. Three of the largest cities in America, the top 10 American cities, are in Texas, and the 11th largest is Austin, where I live. There are another three of the top 10 that are in California, which leaves only four cities in the whole country that aren't in Texas or California among the top 10. So, I find this, the relationship between Texas and California, quite fascinating, because they remind me of like strands of DNA which wrap around each other and don't actually touch, but they they're always in opposition, but they're always twisting and evolving. And the idea that Texas will be eternally red, I think, is a false one. But when it will turn is hard to say. Once it does turn, though, if you take the largest red state and add it to the blue column, the politics of America totally transform.
Tell me a little bit about your life in Austin. I mean, there are some nationally known, artists, that Richard Linklater, the filmmaker, is there.
Yeah.
Who do you hang with?
Well, it's a very intimate artistic community. And one of the things about Austin in that sense is it's not just neighborhoods of writers versus musicians versus actors. Everybody who is in the arts tends to know each other, and I love that. I love that cross-fertilization that you have. When we first moved to Austin, we were on the same block with Terrence Malick, the filmmaker, and Molly Ivins, the humor columnist. And, the filmmakers like Rick Linklater and Robert Rodriguez and Bill Whitliff are all very much a part of the life in Austin. Some of my dearest friends are musicians like Marsha Ball and the guys in my band. We all love to hang out with each other and make music together. So I had a dream once that was, maybe this is a little askew, but my friend Bill Whitliff, who is a filmmaker, came to me in my dream and said, "Austin is Florence." And I don't know what, that meant exactly, but to me it meant that it is a place of artistic imagination where much is being created, and it may not be the center of the earth, it wasn't even Rome, but it was a place where people felt free and entitled to express themselves, and artistically as well as politically and culturally, and that's why I find it such an enriching place to live.
In 2006, your book, The Looming Tower, won the Pulitzer Prize. The story of the rise of al-Qaeda and how it led to the 9/11 attacks. And it's now a dramatic series on Hulu, which I saw the first episode. It's pretty gripping. But, like any dramatization of real events, there's some dramatic license taken with the facts. And as a journalist who has – you've spent all these years taking such pains to get it all right – I know you had a few offers over the years to turn it into a movie or a series. How did you wrestle with the question of how to adapt this to the screen and who to trust to do it?
Well, it became clear to me that somebody was going to do something, whether I liked it or not, in using my material. And I was shy about, trying to find another form to express what happened leading up to 9/11. But when I decided to become a producer and take this book into another medium, what surprised me, and I shouldn't have been so surprised, is how television has changed since the book came out. It's a much more commodious and interesting form of storytelling now than it was then. 10 episodes, it was shot in 8 countries. I mean, it was, the scale of what they were able to do made me feel confident that we could do something worthy and respectful of what happened. There's another reason I wanted to do it, Dave, is You know, in the book, I point out that if the CIA and the FBI had cooperated with each other, the 9/11 plot could easily have been stopped, and it should have been. And just think about if we could roll back history to that moment. You could roll past, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan, now our longest war in history, the invasion of Iraq, perhaps, the torture, the 3,000 Americans killed on 9/11 and the 17 sailors killed on the USS Cole, not to mention all those other attacks by Al-Qaeda. If you could just go back and stop the plot in its tracks, America and the world would be a different place. And it was preventable. But so far, no one has been held to account. No one's come to trial. You know, there were serious mistakes made. And I'm not saying I don't think we will ever have any kind of judicial accounting. But it seemed important to explain, especially to young people for whom 9/11 is not a part of their lived experience, what happened and why? Why did we fail to stop the 9/11 plot? And that's what I hope this series will accomplish.
Lawrence Wright, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, Dave, come back and say hello to Texas.
I will.